Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of Did You Hear What Chocolate Said? I'm just so glad that you're here. I'm your host, Sharon, the Chocolate Writer. Let me first start out by saying thank you for joining me today. You have your choice of thousands of podcasts, and I am grateful you're listening to The Chocolate Girl. I have a serious topic to discuss again today, and I promise some of you are not going to be happy with me by the time I get to the end of this show. Yet, here I am, and I'm going to have my say on some things. So we might as well get started on it, right? Here we go. Being a Gen Xer, you know, I believe we're the greatest generation on earth. Born from the late 60s to 80, we were responsible for and part of some of the greatest occurrences in American history. I was a teenager when Reverend Jesse Jackson ran for president and gave one of the greatest speeches ever at the Democratic National Convention. When I was in college, we witnessed the fall of apartheid in South Africa, a movement in America, spearheaded by young people to boycott that nation until they stopped apartheid. We have been a part of the fall of the Soviet Union as well, when that wall was knocked down in Germany. I witnessed as an adult some notable tragedies too, as a Gen Xer. The Oklahoma City bombing, the Space Shuttle Columbia explosion, the shooting at Columbine, both terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center, and of course the Pentagon as well on 9/11. I've witnessed the greats of sports in their prime, Wayne Gretzky, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, to Michael Jordan, Pete Sampras, Mark Spitz, and Michael Phelps, the U.S. women's gymnastics winning the gold in the Olympics, Pete Rose, Reggie Jackson, to Daryl Strawberry, to Derek Jeter, Jerry Rice, Mean Joe Green, to Tom Brady. Many of the greats have played, and I've been here to witness them all. It's our generation that discovered personal computers, real cell phones, and wireless technology. We've been stewards of some of the greatest advancements in history. One cultural area that things have been shady on is the topic of race. So back in the 50s, we know how things were separate and unequal between white and black people. We know about the federally mandated redlining to keep black people from owning homes. We know about whites-only signs everywhere and how blacks would not ever be put in charge in corporate America. We know about the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and affirmative action and strides made in that area. We know about Shirley Chisholm, Maxine Waters, Secretary of State Colin Powell, Congressman John Lewis, the great Martin Luther King Jr., Congressman John Conyers, and of course, my forever president, Barack Obama, these great black leaders in politics. The advancements in black wealth, black education, despite the history of laws meant to keep black people down, white supremacy, all of that, it still rears its ugly head constantly, even in 2024. We see it. But with all the positive strides in terms of Black Americans, it took a lot for us to get there, to these advancements. The late 80s to 90s was a prickly time in race relations. And when I say race relations, I mean between Black and white Americans. In 1985 in Philadelphia, authorities dropped a bomb on a home on Osage Avenue where the African-American group MOVE was headquartered out of, sparking a huge fire in the neighborhood and killing 11 people. Five of them were children. The city was found liable, but no one was ever criminally charged. 11 people dead and nobody charged criminally. Wow. On March the 3rd, 1991, a video of the Los Angeles police beating a stopped black motorist was broadcast all over the TV stations. The motorist, Rodney King, was severely beaten. King, who was unarmed and on the ground, no longer resisting, when it's seen on video, they kept pounding him with their billy clubs. They left him battered and bloody. The public was in an uproar. King had a broken right leg, bruises and cuts on his face. His eye was swollen shut. He had body bruises and a stun gun burn on his chest. So they even hit him with the stun gun, even with all of that, you know, pounding going on. King, again, who was black, said after the incident, he knelt with his hands spread out and they just kept beating him. And he was in fear for his life. Due to the video, the police chief had to announce that charges would be filed against the white officers. Four of them were tried on excessive force charges, but three were acquitted. The jury failed to reach a verdict on the fourth one. So right after the acquittal, in April of 1992, people took to the streets of L.A. and rioted, mainly because not long before this verdict, a Korean store owner shot a black girl in the back of her head, but she got probation. How she killed a child dead, shooting her from the back and get probation? They beat this man on videotape and got acquitted. No. Folks was up. They were upset about this situation. So in these riots, which lasted days, 63 people died and 2,383 people were injured, ending only when the military got involved to shut it down. So while the city of LA couldn't get a conviction, the federal government civil case that these four officers violated the King's civil rights came to be. And in that case, two out of the four were convicted and sent to prison, and the other two were acquitted. Still not good enough. How two acquitted and only two convicted? It's just crazy. All four of them were visibly seen beating Rodney King. Finally, in the LA civil trial, King was victorious in getting a $3.8 million settlement. The acquittal of those four white officers and ensuing riots left race relations in shambles. It seemed most white people felt, since Rodney King was intoxicated, that he deserved what he got, while most black people disagreed. Many talk shows and news reports were done over the next several years examining these racial tensions. Meanwhile, the LAPD continued racking up complaints of police brutality, mainly against black citizens. Years of black residents being targeted with abuse, disrespect, and trumped up charges by the LAPD fostered a general distrust of the police there by the black community. So in 1994, the black LA community had no trust in their police force. This was the climate when it was announced that Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman were found murdered on June 12, 1994. Nicole Brown Simpson was the ex-wife of O.J. Simpson, Hall of Fame running back from the NFL. It was only a matter of hours before speculation started that OJ killed them. There was the media circus, her funeral, the Bronco chase, which really wasn't a chase, where his best friend Al Cowlings was driving and OJ was in the back seat with a gun saying he was going to kill himself. that chase was broadcast on television by all the news outlets. Finally, he agreed to turn himself in. He was arrested and booked and fingerprinted. His picture was put on the cover of Time magazine that they darkened up, trying to make him look like more of a criminal. I remember Time magazine was blasted for that. OJ was not a dummy, though. He decided to hire the best attorneys he could find. The dream team of his best friend, Robert Kardashian, and then also F. Lee Bailey, Robert Shapiro, Alan Dershowitz, Barry Scheck, Peter Neufeld, Gerald Ullman, Robert Blazer, Carl Douglas, and the leader of all the attorneys, Johnny Cochran. After months of trial, which for the first time ever was broadcast on Court TV, on October 3rd, 1995, he was found not guilty on all charges. Footage of people watching the verdict showed black people cheering and white people distraught. The real, in-your-face evidence that the case had a huge racial component was watching these reactions. Not guilty. I remember my dad and I screaming when the verdict was read. We believed he was innocent. We did not want another innocent black man to be railroaded into prison. I'm often asked, though, why I believe he was innocent of these murders. It's because of what was said at the trial. When you watch interviews with Detective Tom Lange, for example, they always mention how arrogant OJ is. Well, arrogance doesn't equate to murder. OJ, when first questioned by detectives the day after the murders, which he did without attorneys present, they noticed his left finger was cut and bleeding. Then they said the bloody shoe prints at the scene were of the left shoe, and the left glove was supposedly found at the murder scene. But there was no blood found on OJ's body belonging to the victims. And none of OJ's DNA was found at the crime scene. You do understand that if OJ did this and cut his finger at the scene with the glove on and then threw the glove to the ground, that some DNA would have to be present somewhere. No DNA for OJ Simpson was found at that scene. The autopsy showed that both victims fought to save their lives. How did that much of a struggle occur? With all that blood spattered around and zero DNA gets left behind from O.J. Simpson. It's basically impossible. So in the trial, it was proven that four investigating officers tampered with and planted evidence in this case. There was a medical person who testified that given what they say happened and how they were killed, there's no way O.J. could have done that by himself. The injuries, the way they were caused, he could not have done both of those murders with no help, just him by himself. But that's what they said. He did it all by himself. Then there's that glove. It was questioned how and when the glove was found. The defense discovered it was planted by Detective Mark Furman. But when he was asked about that at trial, he pled the Fifth Amendment and refused to answer questions. Also, one detective who had a vial of blood didn't follow police protocol of evidence gathering and went missing with the vial for a while. All of a sudden, there supposedly is blood from the two victims mixed in with OJ's blood found on the Bronco and in his house. All of a sudden. Then there was the glove that everyone talks about that they had at trial. Johnny Cochran famously said in his summation, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. The prosecution had OJ try on the so-called murder gloves. They were too tight. They didn't fit. What most people don't talk about is those gloves were a size large. OJ had huge hands and wore an XXL to a 2XL size glove. That's why I didn't fit. It wasn't because he stopped taking his arthritis medicine so his hands would swell up, which is what people speculate. But guess who wore size large gloves? OJ didn't, but guess who did? Mark Furman. So the jury couldn't trust that evidence either. During trial, someone testified they saw a large shadowy figure going back into OJ's house that night. But they couldn't put OJ there at that particular time. They were never able to find bloody clothes. Some people say he threw them away when he threw away a bag at the airport. Man, they have no evidence of this in trial. This is just public opinion and speculation. People ask me if he didn't do it, who did? I believe OJ knew who did it, but he wasn't the one who did it. I believe it was either his son, who had a history of mental illness, and OJ took the fall for it to protect him, or it was actually Al Cowlings, his best friend. In case you didn't know, OJ's first wife that he met when he was young was Al Cowlings' girlfriend before. And OJ stole her from him. And all these years, Al and OJ went to college and played football together, hung out with friends together. But OJ was always better than Al. Better player, got more friends, more accolades, all the women, including his college girlfriend. And all through their relationship, OJ always was out front and Cowlings was in the background. He never reached the success OJ did, and that could have caused some jealousy. Of course, this is all speculation. I don't know that this is what happened. But so is the take that OJ was guilty. That's speculation too. My question has always been, if there was a mountain of evidence that proved he was guilty, then why did these officers feel the need to plant evidence and fabricate evidence? Also, prior to these murders, the LAPD had gotten several calls from Nicole about OJ beating her. There's pictures everyone has seen of her with cuts and bruises, but he was never convicted of anything. A couple of the officers said one day they'll get him. This could have been the time. This whole story is tragic. Domestic violence is something that should never be tolerated. During the trial, I remember Nicole's sister testifying about an incident where she saw OJ do something to Nicole. Her family knew what was going on, but it came out in evidence that the reason they never got involved or tried to stand up for Nicole is because OJ was their cash cow. OJ's fame and lifestyle was something they all benefited from financially, and they didn't want to lose those perks. Her dad was involved with an investment with OJ where he was making a huge amount of money. They never confronted OJ whenever they saw these incidents. So when I see them talk about this tragedy, for this reason, I think about how they did nothing. If she were my sister, something would have been done. I would have seen to that. So O.J. Simpson has now died of cancer at the age of 76. What angered me is the headlines all say, former NFL great and accused murderer O.J. Simpson died. To me, that's a little distasteful. He was found not guilty in a criminal trial because the evidence was so shady. Yet people know this evidence was tampered with and planted and still say all the evidence says that he did it. That's crazy. So I'm going to end this broadcast today talking about O.J. Simpson's NFL career. I'm going to leave it to everyone else to just continue to tear him down in the upcoming weeks. I know they're going to do it. Orenthal James Simpson was the 1968 Heisman Trophy winner while playing running back at USC. He was the number one overall draft pick in 1969 in the NFL. He won league MVP in 73 and was the league leading rusher several years in the 70s. He became the first running back in the NFL to rush for over 2,000 yards. 2,003 yards to be exact. Playing for the Bills, that's in Buffalo, still the most by any Buffalo Bills player on record. Another record he still holds today is recording an average of 143.1 yards per game across a 14-game season. 14 games, people. Simpson had the most games with 200 yards or more rushing. He's got six of them, tied with only Adrian Peterson and Derrick Henry. His other record, the most games with 250 yards or more rushing, he has two of those. Derrick Henry also now has two and is still playing, so this record could be toppled real soon. OJ played 11 seasons before retiring. He was inducted in the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1985. First ballot. It was less than 10 years after that induction that the murders took place, and just over 10 years when that verdict was announced, not guilty. So no matter how you feel about O.J. Simpson or whether or not you think he's guilty, the tragedy of the murders of Nicole and Ron is a story that will forever bring controversy and debate. The man most people believe killed them is now dead. He was 76 years old. And one thing I am certain of is whatever OJ was guilty of, he is having to stand before God on his own. And no amount of charisma will work on God if he was guilty. So I thank all of you for sticking around to listen to me talk about this subject. It's not easy for me to talk about the O.J. Simpson trial because that was a rough time back then in the 90s. Please make sure to like this episode and subscribe to this podcast. And do me a favor, share the link to this podcast on your pages and in groups that you're in. I'm on my way to doubling my listeners during this fourth season, so help me out with that. So follow me across all social media at Chocolate Writer and The Chocolate Writer on Facebook. Should you need any communications, marketing, or publicity services, head over to thechocolatewriter.com and complete the contact form. So thanks again for joining me, and as always, I wish you love, peace, and chocolate.